The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm pleased to be here to introduce tonight's guest, Jen Psaki. I'm one of those people that thinks government should be boring, and that means it's running well. Having said that, seeing tonight's author having interactions with Peter Doocy fills my heart with glee. Anyway, there you go. Referred to by the New York Times as an unflappable and genial point person, Jen Psaki served as the 34th White House press secretary under President Biden until May 2022. Currently the host of MSNBC's Sunday afternoon and Monday evening program, Inside with Jen Psaki. She spent the previous 20 years in public service. This work includes stints as White House Communications Director under President Obama, as the spokesperson for the State Department under then Secretary of State John Kerry, work on three presidential campaigns, and numerous other campaign and communication roles. She joins us tonight with her latest role, author, and her book, Say More, Lessons from Work, the White House, and the World. Within these pages, she employs her trademark wit and clear-headed analysis to reveal the surprising lessons she learned in the press room and from America's top leaders. She'll be joined in conversation tonight with Annie Duke. She is the best-selling author of Quit, The Power of Knowing When to Walk Away, and Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Have All the Facts. A former professional poker player, she won a World Series of Poker bracelet and is the only woman to have won the World Series of Poker Tournament of Champions. And I will be asking her more about that later. She currently works with First Round Capital Partners, a seed stage venture fund, and teaches executive education at the University of Pennsylvania. In 2023, she completed her PhD in cognitive psychology. She is also the co-founder of the Alliance for Decision Education, a nonprofit whose mission is to improve lives by empowering students through decision skills education. Philadelphia, please join me in welcoming tonight's guests.
I'm just going to say I enjoy Annie so much. We were just chit-chatting, and then we realized we were supposed to come out here.
That's true.
I'm sorry for the delay.
You almost didn't get us. She literally went, oh, wait, we have to go.
I think we should go out there now.
Yeah, exactly. I'm so excited to be here with you. We have a mutual friend connected us, and it's been so fun getting to know you and reading this wonderful book, which I think most of you have. So I think you're going to really enjoy it. We're going to have a talk about it. So I just wanted to start at kind of the why of the book, because I think that, you know, when most people come out of the White House, and you're obviously you very high position as press secretary, what we expect to see in a book is a little bit of a tell-all, right? I mean, this is particularly nowadays. It feels like everybody comes out of these jobs, and then there's a tell-all. And this is very, very much not this book at all. This book is very much a book about how to be a better communicator. So I just wanted to start with a quote that actually is from the back of the book, but I think maybe leads into this so that we can understand sort of why you want to write the book. And I'm just going to quote you here, if that's okay.
Sure.
It's easy to look at someone standing at a podium with a big briefing book, or an executive sitting in a fancy chair at the head of a fancy conference room table, or a star professor in front of a crowded lecture hall, and think that what they're doing has nothing to do with the conversations that go on in the back of the room, around the office coffee machine, or at your child's bedside at 8 p.m. But the same rules for successful communication apply to everyone. I just thought that was really lovely and kind of spoke to this. So I would love to hear from you why this book, why this topic.
thank you, and thank you, and thank you, all of you. And I will just say very quickly, my son, who's six, I spent the day with him here in Philadelphia, and my husband's here too. And my son has decided that cheesesteak is his third favorite food, just behind, with Wiz. He knows how to do it. And it's only behind my husband's cheeseburgers and pizza, so that's like very high ranking. And we've had the greatest day here. So thank you for having me. Thank you for that. The reason I wrote this book or wanted to write this book, and I do think that that captures what I'm trying to get across in this book, is that I've spent 20 plus years working in politics and government on political campaigns. People who know who I am, many people don't, but people who do know me because I was Joe Biden's press secretary. But I'm also many other things, just like everybody is. I'm a mother, I'm a friend, I've worked in offices where I wasn't playing a public role. I've worked in the private sector, I've done a range of things. And in my experience, there are a lot of applicable skills that apply not just when you're at the podium, but apply when you are in a meeting with your bosses, when you are advising or managing teams, when you are talking to your kids, which is the most humbling of all of the things I've ever done, and trying to explain things to them. And so I thought a lot about how to apply all aspects of my life into a book. And I'm just not really a tell-all person. Also, Joe Biden's a really great man and a good empathetic human being, and I mean, you know, it's like I can tell you about the times he like had extra ice cream scoops and stuff, but there's not really. But I didn't want to write that book. I wanted to write a book that somebody who is starting their career younger than me, or maybe even not, maybe just curious, but the book I wish I would have had when I was in my 20s. That's the book I wanted to write.
Yeah, I love that. So I will say, just for as people read it, you will see there are some fun details in the book.
Like, there are fun stories.
The time you dumped the contents of your purse out over Obama's lap.
Yeah.
Or you have a great scene of Rahm Emanuel like jumping on a table.
Yes.
Which maybe we'll get into a little bit of that. We'll see. So just before we kind of dig into content, I just want to talk a little bit more about what you just talked about, because I feel like one of the things that is hard, and I just want to get your thoughts on this, is when you have a very public-facing persona, mm-hmm. and that's kind of how people end up defining you. Mm-hmm. And it feels to me a little bit like in this book you're trying to say, look, I'm here, and I'm more than the thing that you know me as. Mm-hmm. And I would love to hear how you feel about my read of that.
Yes, and you and I have talked about this, and that is very much part of what I wanted to show in this book, in large part because I think when people see somebody who is at a podium, who is a performer, who is an anchor, who is a singer, I'm not all of those things, I'm tone deaf, I think, but anyway, who plays a public role, there can be a perception that you are just like that all the time, that you just came out of the earth like that, that you don't screw up, that you don't make mistakes, that you don't have tough days. And to me, I wanted to share, a lot of this book has a lot of mistakes I've made, things I wish I would have handled differently, because I actually think vulnerability is strength, and it's not something that you hear a lot about. And so to me, I wanted to share all the aspects of how I got to where I am, not just the moments where I had a front seat to history. I had many of them. There are certainly stories about them in the book, but that was important to me because I don't think people always showcase that. And that is what I think sometimes leads to, and now I'm not the expert, so as I say this, you may be like, what are you talking about? our mutual friend, Adam Grant, who you guys probably know of, I remember talking to him about imposter syndrome, right? And how I still felt oftentimes like, oh my God, why is anyone going to watch my show? You know, and why is anyone going to listen to what I have to say at the podium? I've had these conversations with people that would blow your mind. I mean, Supreme Court justices. I mean, like comedians who were famous. Like people who have similar feelings about being out in public. And I thought it was so important to tell stories of that. And that's what I wanted to do in the book.
Yeah, I love that. I think obviously in your job you come off as so self-confident, and then it's such a, for a lot of people it creates a comparison that's negative, and we don't necessarily realize that you have an internal life as well. And you have insecurities also. And I think that the vulnerability that you show in this book is so incredibly important, so that people understand that we're all kind of the same and we can all have a great conversation with each other.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I've also found that people, and maybe this is a human nature factor, people like to categorize you or put you in a box, right?
Very
much
so.
This is true of politicians and true of so many people who have had any version of a public life. And it's everybody's multifaceted and multi-layered. And anyway, that's what I wanted to talk about in the book.
Well, I love that. That makes me want to maybe start in a different place, but I'm going to start where I was planning to start.
Ahead.
How about that? So let's actually just start with, this book is such a great book for someone who wants to become a better communicator. And I love that that's where you dug into. Obviously, that's where your expertise is. And I love that you chose not to do the tell-all, and you chose really actually to help people be better communicators in all aspects of their life, right? So you identify three broad principles of audience engagement, which is really what you're doing at the podium, right? Mm-hmm. The three are: identify your target audience, craft your message, and lower any barriers to engagement. Could you just explain and expand on those principles? And maybe you could use Biden's infrastructure bill and the communication around that as a way to frame that up.
Sure. So I always tell people, if somebody says to you, my audience is everyone, your audience is no one, because you have to identify who your audience is, because communicating is about achieving an objective. Now, sometimes it's about passing a bill. Sometimes it's about negotiating something with a foreign country. Sometimes it's about getting your kid to eat vegetables. Sometimes it's about convincing your spouse to go on a vacation you want to go on. I mean, there's a range of goals, right? But identifying who your audience is so important. And when I was in the press secretary, we were working to pass the infrastructure bill back in 2021. And what we thought a lot about is how we wanted to create a forum or a bridge, shall I say, even though it was an infrastructure bill, for, I had that in my back pocket.
That was good.
The bridge. People who didn't, members of Congress who didn't vote for the president, who didn't necessarily agree with him on a lot of issues, to support this piece of legislation. Because who is against, I doubt anyone in this room, better roads, bridges, more broadband access, clean drinking water, things along those lines. And we knew that, therefore, our audience was not just the progressive wing of the Democratic Party or even just Democrats. It had to be broader than that, because those are initiatives that are supported by the majority of the American public, but not the majority of people in Congress, because things can get so political and partisan at times. So therefore, the way we talked about the infrastructure bill was not in a partisan or political way. It was in, and not in an overly specific way. I mean, these bills are hundreds of pages long, which, by the way, is not popular with the public. Nobody likes hundreds of pages of bureaucratic bills, right? Mm-hmm. And so we talked about it through broad principles and things that gave people a bridge to support the bill. And 17 Republican senators voted for the bill. So it was not solely at all because of what I said at the press briefing, but it's just an example I talk about in the book about how in government you really think about who your audience is and you have to identify it so you can shape your message accordingly.
So I love that. So, you know, who are you actually talking to? And obviously, I'm sure that you went through with this book. I've done that with my book, where you actually have to identify who your core audience is. And publishers will always say, if you say everybody, that's a very bad answer.
It's a bad answer.
And you've talked about crafting your message. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by lowering barriers to engagement?
So I had a very humanizing, of which I've had many, and anyone who's a parent in here knows this, experience when I was going to go back and work for President Biden. He was the president-elect. His team had reached out to me about whether I was interested in the press secretary job. Of course I was. I talked about this in the book too, but I'd been twice the bridesmaid for the job, as I like to say.
Yes.
Before I did the job, I was the runner-up twice. And my daughter was 5 at the time, so old enough to understand, but not old enough to really capture the whole understanding of what was happening in the country or things going on. She loves frozen yogurt, Sweet Frog in particular, where you kind of put 12 different flavors and kind of a disgusting combination of gummy worms and all sorts of things. And I took her there, and that was my effort to lower the barrier for engagement with her. And I thought to myself, okay, I'm a big prepper. I prepare for things. I literally wrote out what I wanted to say to her, and I thought, this is a moment I'm going to teach her about patriotism and serving the country. I know, see, all the parents and grandparents in here know where this headed, right? It was not successful. But I sat her down and I said, so you know that nice man, Joe Biden, who won the election, which is a funny way to describe him, but she was five. And she said, uh-huh. And I said, he's asked me if I can come help him, which is, again, another funny thing to say about what the job is. And I said, so if I do that job, I'm going to have to spend a lot of time, and it will be a sacrifice, because I will sometimes not be able to be there for you for things you're doing. And that also means you're sacrificing, and that's good for the country. I know some people are nodding, like, it's pretty good, right? It's pretty good. It's pretty good. And I said, and I was like, oh, that was very good. And I said, does that make sense? She goes, no. Okay, great. And the story I tell was humbling. I kind of laughed to myself at that moment. But I continue the story in the book, because what I learned, which I've learned many times as a professional as well, is that it's not about always the words you use or the speeches. It's about how you make people feel. That's what communicating is about. Engagement with people, how they feel when they listen to you, or if they're willing to listen to you. And so if you fast forward 8-9 months later, we couldn't have family members or anyone really visit the White House because of COVID. So really, it was the pardoning of the turkeys. Do you remember this happens every year? They get to sleep in a hotel the night before, which I just find so funny. But their names were Peanut Butter and Jelly. They were very large. My daughter and my son came with me. We sat outside. They had this amazing day. They met the president. They met the press. People, my daughter loves the Today Show. She saw where they do, you know, shoot interviews for the Today Show. Amazing. Came to my office. All the things. We got her a drink at the White House mess. And there's a big soda machine. And she got to pick anything she wanted. And she picked a Sprite. She'd never had a Sprite before. She picked the Sprite. We walked out of the building. They gave us cookies on our way out. They said, the president wanted you to have these. I was like, what a cool day. So we're walking out. And I said, what was your favorite part? Was it meeting the president? Was it what? She was like, I love Sprite, Mom. I've never had it before. And the president makes great cookies. So that was my lesson. Then after that, she loved where I worked. So that was my experience with her, but it is very applicable professionally, certainly in politics, in government, but anytime you're communicating with anyone, that how you make people feel is really what defines successful communications.
I love that. That's such a that whole story, and that's in the book is so wonderful. So I'm just gonna, I think you quote Maya Angelou on this point, so I just want to repeat the quote that you have in the book, because I think it really underlines this. People will forget what you said, but people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. And I just thought that was such a great way to express this idea that to be a great communicator, it's not just about what you say, and in some ways that's actually less important than what is the experience or the feeling that they have walking away from that. And it's such a beautiful way to think about speaking to people. So that kind of brings me into this idea that you talk about in the book about, you know, one of the things that we need to remember, and I think this connects to this idea of how do you make people feel, is that people really think in stories. And from my background as a cognitive scientist, we talked about this, this makes me think of something called the identifiable victim effect, which is, you know, like fancy science word for, tell people a story of someone, don't give someone statistics, in particular if you want them to give you money or engage with you. So it's really common. So let's say I'm trying to raise money because I want to fund wells for clean water in Africa, so that people in Africa who live in villages can have water that's closer to them. I can either tell you all the statistics about how few people have access to water and how many people have to walk over 2 miles to get clean water and the amount of disease that's directly attributed to that, and I give you all sorts of statistics, and you will not write me a very big check. But if I tell you about a kid, just one kid, who has to walk 2 miles to go get water every day, and he can't go to school because he's spending all his time going back and forth to try to help his family out, you will write me a pretty large check. And interestingly enough, if I tell that story and then follow it with statistics, you will go back to not writing me a check. That's how important stories are.
You didn't tell tell me that last
part. Oh, I didn't tell you the last part.
Although that rings so true.
Yes. You ruin it. Yeah, and we, of course, we intuitively think, well, if I tell you the story and then I really tell you the magnitude of the problem, it's going to be better. But that's actually not true. It moves you into the wrong part of your brain, number one, because the left hemisphere doesn't like giving money. But the other thing is then the problem seems too big for you to help, I think, is part of it as well. And you're not connected, as you point. Like, how do you feel you're connected to the problem? So I would love for you to sort of talk about, like, How do you, as a communicator, think about leveraging the idea that people do think in stories?
Yeah, this is so true. And this is true when you're communicating with a handful of people, and it's true when you're communicating with millions of people. And the example I give, and there's so many examples of this, when Annie told me this, I was like, this is true in political fundraising, too. It's very true. If you look at... You probably get 7,000 emails. Yes. I mean, I'm annoyed. I'm like, please stop sending me these emails. So I can't, you know, we get it. But it's true in political fundraising too. But the example I give that is very applicable here in the book is about the Affordable Care Act. Because I worked for President Obama all 8 years, on and off. And when we were passing the Affordable Care Act, no one loves statistics, data, charts, like people who work in government. And I love public servants and people who work in government. I think they're the best human beings on the planet, but like we love paper and data and charts. And our message around the Affordable Care Act in the initial months and years even was, it's going to bend the cost curve. Okay. What does that mean? It means lower the cost, but I mean, it's kind of, you have to think about it for a second. It doesn't exactly roll off the tongue. That was the big message early on. The Affordable Care Act was very unpopular. While we were doing bend the cost curve with our data and kind of like very well-meaning nerds who are punching numbers, we had Sarah Palin and others talking about death panels, and it was like not a fair game on the messaging front. I mean, that was dark and dangerous, but people connected to it. It really took... Fast forwarding probably to almost the second term, or maybe even the second term, probably campaigning for President Obama's reelection, to realize that actually the best way to communicate about the Affordable Care Act was the personal stories and people whose lives were saved because of it, because they had a pre-existing condition and they could cover it, because they could keep their child on health care who was under 25, because for the range of many, many reasons that it saved lives. And we started finding people who could talk about their stories, and they would introduce President Obama at events. We told their stories online, et cetera. The other thing that is a very powerful messaging tool, and you can see this with abortion rights and access right now, is when something is being taken away or the threat of it being taken away, even people who didn't think about it regularly or may not be personally impacted want it and don't want it to be taken away. And that can be that is another very powerful messaging tool when you have sometimes you're unfortunately in that situation. But
so you just need to come talk to me first and stop showing the graphs. I would have told you that
graphs.
Back then.
Right.
No,
exactly.
So you've mentioned bridges. And obviously now you've mentioned the Affordable Care Act. So I want to bring those two things. I'm going to bring those two things together. So one of the things I think that is, you know, alarming to everybody in our society right now is the amount of tribalism that there is. We are so divided up into my tribe, your tribe, and the tribe that you're in so affects the way that you frame mm-hmm. and interpret information. And I think that it's like the bridge is, but you know, it's like the bridge is up. It's not down right now, right? There is no bridge between those two sides. It feels like a lot. And you talk in the book a lot about, you know, sort of communicating around the ACA mm-hmm. and Obamacare as it relates to this problem of tribe mm-hmm. and this ability of people to. My tribe likes it, I'm now going to reframe it as good, or my tribe likes it, I'm going to reframe it as bad. So first of all, I'd love for you to sort of just give an example of sort of what happened with, I'll say ACA, but Obamacare, right? And then how you as a communicator at that point really were trying to address that problem.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the ACA is so interesting for a lot of reasons. One of them is that it was originally an idea from the Heritage Foundation, which is not exactly a liberal outlet. Yeah, right? And Mitt Romney, who now is maybe still a Republican, I guess still, but like, but at the time he was of course the nominee for the Republican Party. He had successfully gotten a version of the ACA passed in Massachusetts. So anyway, the origin of it was not at all from the progressive political wing of a party at all, and it became identified. So actually, there was interesting polling at the time where people would say, do you like the ACA or do you like the healthcare that's the new program in your state? And people would say, yeah, I love it. It's great. And it was the same thing they were asked about. They would give details. Do you like Obamacare? No, I hate it, right? So what is important if you're working in government is you have to be humble about the fact that sometimes you're not the best messengers. And we found this to be very much the case when it came to communicating about COVID. Because COVID, obviously people getting vaccinated and doing things to protect themselves at the height of COVID especially, was important to save lives. The president, the vice president, even me, were not the right messengers for that because we would immediately turn people off. So we worked to develop a plan that we didn't even necessarily really announce of really identifying local leaders. Sometimes they were faith leaders, sometimes they were mayors or others, sometimes they were just community leaders, to be the deliverers of the message, because they were more trusted than U.S. government officials, because they weren't seen as partisan. And so the thing about effectively communicating is sometimes you have to recognize you're not always the right person to be saying it.
Yeah, so it's sort of getting out of tribe, or getting out of the tribe that's going to create the reaction that's going to cause someone to reject the information. Yeah. I think it is so interesting. I think you talked about, was that Jimmy Kimmel?
Yes.
Who did like a man on the street kind of thing?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, where asking about the ACA versus Obamacare, right?
Yes.
Which is sort of reflecting the polling, of course.
Yes.
I think that it's so true that that's the power of tribe. And I do feel like that is something that is such a big issue right now in terms of how are we supposed to bridge this. So, you know, I just want to give another quote from the book and then talk a little bit more about tribe as it relates to like social media, maybe Peter Doocy a little bit.
My friend.
Why not? By the way, there's a great picture in the book of Jen standing next to Peter Doocy, and you're 5'3", right? And he's 6'5"?
Five.
We took
it on the last day. We actually had quite a good relationship. One of the most common questions people ask me, after they ask me what Joe Biden like, which is obviously a good question. Oh, these are all good questions. But how much do you hate Peter Doocy? And I say, not at all. I don't hate Peter Doocy.
Yeah.
But we took a picture on the last day that I was in the White House, and we put it out on social media. We both posted it, and it was like, people's mind. There was like a theory that I was like 4'3". I mean, it was just, there was a lot of funny things that were happening, but yes.
It does look a little like that, because unless you know he's 6'5",
yes.
You're like, why is he, what was she standing on behind the podium?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so let me just give this quote, and then maybe we can talk about sort of the online world and tribe and how it affects what you're talking about in this quote, which I think is just such a beautiful quote. So you say, successful communication is sometimes about building a bridge where there wasn't one before. Sometimes all you need is a footbridge to traverse a stream. Sometimes you need a suspension bridge that spans miles and miles. That requires much more planning, effort, and resources to build. Of course, it's great if the person on the other side just walks or drives across. That's always the hope. But they first need to see the bridge and then determine for themselves that the structure is sturdy enough to support both of you. Isn't that beautiful? Right? Like, should we all live that a little bit more?
Mm-hmm.
So you know, in terms of bridge building, sort of let's start here before we get into the online world. One of the things that you say is that effective communication is first and foremost about getting people to listen, which I imagine is a little bit the footbridge across a stream, right? But you know, when I read that, I was like, oh, that's a really interesting thing to say, because particularly in your job, I would think that you would think that it's first and foremost about getting people to change their opinion, right? So if you can sort of talk to that.
Sure. I mean, ultimately, sometimes the goal is for them to change their opinion, but that's not the only goal, is the point. And sometimes that's not possible, and sometimes it's not possible on everything. I mean, I worked at the State Department for years, and one of the things you learn about diplomacy internationally is that you have to work with a lot of governments where you may have a lot of disagreements, but maybe you can find some commonality to move something positive forward. But I would say that one of the things that I, in the listening piece of this, I think is so key, because listening, I think, is one of the most undervalued parts of communicating effectively. This is very true now as a person who's hosting a television show. And when I was started at MSNBC, one of my bosses said to me, "Nobody at home knows your plan." Meaning, you don't, if you have a list of 10 questions for someone, and on question 3, they say something so interesting and unexpected about North Korea, don't then ask them a question about healthcare next. Meaning, because maybe they said something, and that's where you should continue. So listening is so important. But I learned a lot about this bridge building, actually, from Barack Obama, who I recognize a lot of people in the country, less so now because he's a former president, people don't care, but don't like, and that's okay. But when he was running for president, I mean, he's an African-American guy who's a constitutional law professor from the South Side of Chicago, right? He won the Iowa caucus. And he did that in part, and I worked for him at the time, by going into people's living rooms, sitting at their table, and asking them about their lives and listening to them and surprising people. And sometimes that bridge is about listening and looking for and finding that connection. I'm not suggesting you will find, we will all find that with everybody, no matter what your views are.
Right.
But that piece of it, I learned a lot from him. And he jokes still to this day, yeah, a guy named Barack Hussein Obama who won parts of rural Iowa, nobody would ever think that, right? But he walked in parades, he was in people's living rooms, and he did find points of connection, because there are points of connection. Oh, you're struggling with healthcare? My mother died of cancer because she didn't have great access to healthcare. Oh, you have little kids? I get it. I also am like spending hours at night trying to convince them to go to bed. There are connections, and I learned a lot from watching him do that in campaign.
Yeah, so, you know, obviously what you're really talking about there is sort of going back to that he was able to bridge the gap, right? Mm-hmm. Between, you know, who he was or who they perceived him to be, and them, a lot through listening and just sort of letting them know, I guess back to the beginning of our conversation, that he had an inner life as well.
Yes.
Right, that there was more to him than maybe what they had heard, which allowed for that connection. So, you know, obviously 2008 is a little bit, you know, you know, we were all kind of Luddites back then, right? Like, mm-hmm. we didn't have the technology that we have now. And it feels like things are sort of drastically changing. So I'd love to hear just your thoughts on, you know, how has the online world really affected our ability to build bridges and communicate with each other?
Well, there are some very obvious things that everybody in here probably has seen and maybe even experienced, which is that any social media platform rewards extremes. It rewards by more likes, by more retweets, by more shares. And that in itself rewards division. Nobody's negotiating anything on Twitter. I think it's very clear, right? Yeah. At the same time, these platforms level the playing field in many ways and allow many people to communicate to broad audiences. And I think that is ultimately a good thing. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. But what I've found, especially not with all, but with people who work, I work with who are in their 20s and even early 30s, is that, and I'm sure people older than them as well, is that there's this like loss of an ability to communicate in person. I'm not saying you can't do shit Snapchat. I don't know how to do it really, but like for people who want to do it, go forth. Yeah. But I'm not saying don't do that. All I'm saying is there's a loss of the ability and an awkwardness about having a hard conversation, having a difficult conversation, providing feedback, giving feedback. I swear not to be funny, but I mean, some of the 20-somethings on my team like don't know how to ask somebody out on a date. Like they just like are like, how should I get set up? It's like, well, you've met the person 20 times. Should you just like not ask them? Does it not how it goes anymore? So that's sort of a lighter version. But I do think that part of this, part of my view is that it's technology is amazing. You know, my dad lives in Colorado. My in-laws live in Ohio. they know their grandkids so much better because of FaceTime. And it's, there's so many advances, but I also think it's been a crutch. And it has allowed people to become online bullies of sorts. And I've experienced this in the sense of people attacking me by name in online, and then you may run into them at a conference, and it's like, hey, how are you? And they're like, oh, hi. And it's like, oh, right. Remember like 3 days ago? So it's allowed a forum for that. And I think a lot of that's quite damaging. But some of what we can do as humans is find ways we can disagree. Disagreement is healthy. Disagreement's part of our democracy. That's all good. It's we can find a better way to do that as individuals, though.
So this reminds me, actually, I just had a conversation the other day with Lori Santos, who is a professor at Yale. She has a podcast called The Happiness Project. She has a class on happiness at Yale. Yes. It's the most popular class at Yale.
Yeah, I want to take it. Who years. Among us? Should
well,
we
you
all
can,
take
you
it?
Can actually, you can take it on Coursera.
Oh, okay. Perfect.
Yeah, so they have a version that all of you can take it. And one of the things that she recommends in there that's really proven is that we've lost one of the things that predicts happiness the most. And the English-speaking world is just a lot less happy than it used to be, probably because most of the news is coming in mm-hmm. English, but is just spend time face-to-face like this,
mm-hmm.
but in real time. So I think we think like texting, for example, creates that connection, but it doesn't because it's not in real time. FaceTime is good. Zoom is good. We loved it during COVID for sure,
mm-hmm.
right? But and I think that also goes to the bullying, right? Is that when you don't see someone face to face, they aren't humanized for you. Mm-hmm. So actually this morning I was gonna do a little bit more work preparing for this, and I took a walk with a friend because I had talked to Lori Santos the other day.
Oh, I love that.
So it just makes me think of that there's other reasons besides sort of the splitting part of society, but for your own happiness, really getting in and communicating with somebody face-to-face is so incredibly important.
Yes, 100%.
So, again, so we're skipping around because I'm trying to follow what you said, and you just said something, in my view, interesting about North Korea. So I mean, I'm going to analogize to that because you talked about bullying.
Yeah.
Right. So can you just talk a little bit about sort of how you dealt with, because I think that we all have felt this in our life. You were bullied on a scale that I'm sure none of us have experienced because the Russian government decided to bully you. So I know, right? So first of all, I would love you to talk about that. And, you know, you talk about it with such grace and humor in the book. And I'm sure it was difficult, but I think there's such a good lesson in how you sort of dealt with that, right? That we could all learn from.
Thank you for that. I will first say that this was about 10 years ago. So I was, or more, I mean, I was 33, 34, about that old when I became the target of the Russian propaganda machine. And if you're wondering how that feels, it does not feel good. But at the time, 2014, 2015, now we're all familiar with Russian propaganda. Putin obviously is not a popular figure around the world at this moment in time. At the time, we weren't as a country, or even at the media was not as knowledgeable about the Russian propaganda machine and the Kremlin's use of propaganda. And this was during the time when Russia invaded Ukraine back in 2014. I was the spokesperson at the State Department, which this may sound odd, but by default, I became essentially the face of one of the major faces of the U.S. position in opposing that illegal invasion, I should say, because I gave a briefing every day. Because of that, the Kremlin and the Russian government decided they needed to discredit me, which is what propaganda is for and why they do it. At the time, I did not know this. At the time, I just thought, why are they being so mean to me? What is going on? But it was relentless. They had a show every night on RT, which is their Russian propaganda television station, which is not just in Russia. It's in Europe. You used to be able to find it in the United States. They made up a term, Russian government did, called sakiing, which meant making up at something that you were confused by. This is all because I would go out and say they illegally invaded another country, a sovereign country. That's why. So they came after me. Now, I started getting, and this is the story I tell in the book, questions from U.S. media, not from malintent, just because they weren't as informed, saying, What is your response to suggestions that you are becoming an issue in the relationship between the United States and Russia, right? So, you know, you read emails like that and you're like, what do I say to this? And it feels pretty dark and isolating. And I do talk about that in the book. A lot of it was also quite gendered, their attacks on me as well. How I looked, what I wore, all sorts of things. And it actually took, the State Department press corps is really remarkable. They're brilliant. They know as much as many people who work in government about foreign policy. They're just an amazing group of people. And one of them, many of them, had covered Russia, had worked in Moscow. And one of them, who was a former Moscow bureau chief for the New York Times, said to me, you know this is like a badge of honor, right? I mean, they're going after you because they think you're effective, and they're worried you're going to reach their public. And so they have to relentlessly kind of go after you and take down your credibility. That was a real turning point for me. I mean, I still had to deal with it, but it empowered me to recognize I had to kind of fight back and call out what they were doing and call out that they were going after me, not because I wasn't sharing accurate facts, I was, but because they didn't like what I was saying. That's essentially what I said. Now, the slightly funny part, there's a couple funny parts of the story, but one of them is, fast forward to when Joe Biden was president, Vladimir Putin, still there. He's been around. He has like 100 lives, that person. But they had a summit. At the summit, I'm with the president at the summit, but I'm not at the press conference because it's very small. And we'd prepped the president. We were watching the press conference, but it was a press conference that Putin was doing by himself. And so I was still with Joe Biden at the time. Out of nowhere, he brings me up. I think this was at his press conference, yes. He brings me up and says that I'm like educated, but ill-informed. It's like he hadn't let it go 8 years later. So I found at the time, I found that funny. I was like, ugh, I'm still under his skin. All right. But yes, propaganda. And what I learned from that, you know, hopefully no one here is ever a victim of Russian propaganda. If you are banned from going to Russia, join me. I have not been able to go there for 10 years. I can't get a visa. But it is when bullies attack you, not all, but when bullies attack, when propagandists attack, and unfortunately we're seeing some versions of this in our own country right now, it's because of the effectiveness of the alternate argument. And the motivation of it doesn't mean you can solve it. It just means it's helpful to know in your mind as you're figuring out how to fight back.
I love that story so much. I mean, that they had a half-hour show just about you. that's quite something.
I was a parent reporter. I don't know. I mean, reporters told me I was on, like, enemy of the state Kremlin playing cards. Like, I never saw them. I had, like, a warrant for my... It was, like, me and John Brennan, who was the CIA director. Yeah. We had warrants for our arrest in Crimea. It was like, what am I doing? I don't know. So there was a lot of things that were a little crazy at the time, but...
I think I have time for one more question. I'm so sad because I have like 17 pages of questions, but I knew this was going to happen. So I'm trying to decide which one I want to do as my last one. So, okay. So this is one that actually, so this is one that reminded me of something my son would do. So my son would come home some days from school when he was in high school or middle school, and he'd be that.
There's my sister.
Everybody, husband and child. Let's give them a round of applause.
He'll be back for cheesesteak.
Yes, the brand new cheesesteak lover. Okay, so my son would come home from school some days, and he would be in a fight with one of his friends. And he would say, other people agree with me. And I found that upsetting. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I never connected in this way until I was reading this in your book, but there is a kind of rhetorical device that some people, maybe that we're not gonna name, use all the time, which is people are saying. Yeah. Right?
This literally triggers me.
Right, people are saying.
It's like,
so. So I think
no matter who does it,
right? Exactly. Well, my son did this, right? I mean, my son would do this. I've had friends that I'm in fights with. Say, people are saying, you know, and I used to say, you're recruiting an invisible army. Mm-hmm. But I thought you had a very good way of handling it, because what you found was that once that started happening, the people are saying that some people in the press corps adopted people are saying.
Yes.
And I think that you have, this is such a great practical strategy for dealing with this sort of people are saying thing. So maybe as the last question, you could speak
to
that.
So when I came in with President Biden, it had become a tactic that the press corps had adapted. I know I don't have to preface with everybody here, but I have a huge amount of respect for the White House press corps. You couldn't do that job if you didn't. But it had just become a thing that they would do, was say, people are saying this, people are saying that. And I would say, who's saying? You know? It's like, who's saying? And I wasn't trying to be a jerk. I was actually, it matters who's saying.
Right.
Because if you're talking about the negotiation of a bill and the reporter says, well, actually, I talked to six senators today and these six senators are saying they're not going to support that bill. Okay, that's significant. If they're saying I talked to a couple people on the street, it's not unimportant, but I'm not sure it's like changing the trajectory of the bill. What, or maybe it is and we don't know and we should speak to the broad support it has. But there's a particular example I give where it's like this reporter says, well, people are saying that the president's strategy on immigration is just ineffective. And I wouldn't even know what I was saying. I said, well, who's saying that? Well, I'm not sure how you're going to respond to this, but the person saying that is President Trump. And I was like, Donald Trump is criticizing Joe Biden? I was like, well, I mean, they just ran against each other. They ran against each other in a campaign. I'm not sure. I wasn't even trying to have a partisan debate in the moment at all. But I will say that no matter what conversation you're having, if it's your neighbor, or your child, your friend, it's like, well, my friends are saying, I do this to my kids, my friends are saying, well, which friends? Who friends are saying that? You know, like, which person? Which neighbor? And a lot of times it gets people a little like, oh, well, it's one person, you know?
Right.
So, you know, it's a tactic to use, I should
say.
Well,
I love that. I'm hoping that somebody in the audience will ask about the time you CC'd the whole Iowa press corps, but on a private communication.
Oh, yeah, many mistakes. Or the time I didn't know who Chance the Rapper was.
Right, the time.
That was bad. I sat next to him at a state dinner. I didn't know who he was.
Right.
It's very awkward.
Yes.
Research. Do your research.
So I'm so sad. I feel like I need about two more hours with you to go through all of this, but I need to give the audience now a chance to ask. So if people could raise their hand, I'll call on you, and please wait to speak until the mic comes to you.
Hello, thank you for coming.
Hi, thank you.
Having clarified that you do not hate Peter Doocy, when you're at the press conference and the whole world is watching, what lesson of yours did you use to keep your composure and still answer professionally when he has spewed a mean-spirited question?
I would say, you know, to me, when I was coming in and I started the job, one of the things that President Biden asked me to do was to try to lower the temperature in the briefing room and take the venom out of the exchanges. Now, there were heated exchanges and you have debates and that's okay and healthy. But it was important to me, and I recommended and decided we were going to call on Fox every day. And other outlets that may have disagreed or reported negative things about the president, because that was an important message to send. With Peter Doocy, I will say first that when you're in the press brief, when you're in the press secretary's office, there's four televisions, and you watch cable all day and see what they're covering. And it can be a bit predictable on what they were going to ask about. So many days, I didn't know the questions, but if they were doing all-day coverage on immigration, I knew that the question in the briefing room was probably going to be about immigration. And I say that because then I used it as an opportunity to share what we were doing and what the president's view was on that particular issue. Not because I thought I was going to win Peter Doocy over or necessarily everybody watching, but because I wanted to provide some facts that people could use who may have been having those conversations with their friends and neighbors that they could use effectively. The other thing I will say, and I mentioned this in my book, and she's a friend of mine, is Dana Perino, who was George Bush's press secretary. She wrote a book, and in her book, I never did this, but she wrote about how in the podium, there is a space for a mug for water. And I never brought water out there. I don't really know why. I think I was afraid I was going to dump it or lose it or something. She wrote in her book that when people were driving her crazy in the briefing room, she would just put her hand in there and flip the bird at the reporters. I never did that, but I think that future people might do that to some people.
Yes. And I would like to say before the next question that this, you know, this idea of coming in and like making a decision to call on Fox News every day, you know, again, you talk a lot about building bridges and talking across divides and trying to meet people where they are. And a little fact is you were on Fox Sunday more than any other Sunday show. So you really embodied and lived that principle.
Yes, and I did. And you had to accept that having the, if you reached a small percentage of people or just representing, I'm not afraid of having this conversation. We can have this conversation. Right. And that in itself is sending a message sometimes.
Yeah.
Hi, thank you so much for being here. Early in your book, you talk about how you really like when people underestimate you because you like to prove them wrong.
Oh my God, I love it still to this day.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that, about any, like what you do when you encounter people who underestimate you, what kind of tactics and strategies you use?
I will say, I mean, I'm 45 years old. I'm still underestimated all the time. And I will tell you just briefly and then I'll answer your question. I was in New Hampshire maybe a couple of months ago, and I was there anchoring hours and hours and hours of TV about the New Hampshire Republican primary. I had tons of Republicans on, reporters. It was just, I was there for the network. I had one particular, he happened to be male, which doesn't matter, but maybe it matters, unclear, who was on one of my panels afterwards say to me, I'm so happy for you that you have the opportunity to be here in New Hampshire. And I said, okay. I said, well, what do you mean by that? Well, it's just that you've never done this before. And I said, well, I mean, I worked on 3 presidential campaigns. I've been around politics. Well, anyway, I'm just happy that they gave you this chance, okay? So I share that because that was literally in February. So, and I share that because I think it's important. It's like my belief, and I write about this in this book, and also people that I work with now who are quite successful, or I've gotten advice from, like George Stephanopoulos and Rachel Maddow, they're always striving to be better, always, like, and always beating themselves up about things they did wrong. To me, that's a motivator. But when people underestimate me, it's a motivator because I'm like, I have something to prove. So I use it as a fuel. How do I do that? I kind of think about stories like the one I just told you. And I think, I'm going to prove that person wrong, right? And that is a motivator. I actually would prefer to be underestimated, frankly, because then you can be, you can be deciding how you're going to write your own story, and you're not trying to meet the expectations of someone who is trying to put you in a particular place. So I prefer it, actually. And that's how I think about it.
That reframe is beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
The idea of if you're underestimated, that gives you a chance to write your own story as opposed to pressure to meet somebody else's expectations. What a beautiful way to think about it.
Loyal MSNBC watcher.
Oh, thank you.
I also, in January 20th, 2009, I was the president's guard. I have a picture. I was...
Oh, my God, I love that.
I have the picture with me. I do have the picture with me.
That's amazing.
Matter of fact, I was down at my old job in Washington last Thursday getting some records for Columbia University. That's another issue, but for school. But I have my disagreements with some of the coverage that you said on there, defending my college, Columbia University.
Sure.
But I am a combat soldier, so.
Thank you for your service.
I will be very careful about what I say, but if you ever have time, I'm a member of the Wounded Warrior Project.
Amazing. Thank you.
You are welcome to meet with us. I will tell my group leader, if you want to come meet with us, I'm a member.
I'd love to.
And I would love to get that. I've never been to the White House yet. Although I've been to combat twice.
We got to make it happen. I have some homework here. Is there any tea you want on any MSNBC people? I'll just tell you all the secrets.
Well, I've already been with Chris Hayes. My mom has the letter from President Trump for her 100th birthday.
Oh, wow. Okay.
She actually died. She'll be dead 6 years this year. She died 2018, actually 1 week short of 100. But you know, as a White House Secretary, that has to be done in March.
No, that's
months.
Amazing.
So I have Trump's letter. I also have a letter that went to the president. I hope you get a chance to tell him about it, for the I was brought back from Iraq, my second tour of duty. I can't tell you about this because I was a military police officer. It's classified, that mission. But I was put up for the highest combat medal of honor, the Soldier's Medal. We couldn't do nothing through the politicians, the congressmen, including my cousin. My cousin is Dwight Evans. I'm the cousin of Dwight Evans. You know my yeah. aunt Jean. But if you'd like to address my friends from MSNBC, who love you to death.
Thank you. Thank you for your service. Maybe you should write a book. I want to read your book.
Next question. Let's see, right here in the plaid.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. I'm intrigued with what the nuts and bolts day-to-day is at the White House.
Sure.
Now, I know it's a tough question to answer.
Yeah.
But I thought if you could contrast it, compare it, President Biden's White House and President Barton's White House, because I know Barton's White House well. Are they similar at all? Is that what goes on? Is there someone throwing the ball on the wall?
You know what's so funny is Lawrence O'Donnell, for anybody who watches MSNBC, he was one of the original writers of The West Wing, too. He's amazing, and he's a friend. And he and I have talked about this a lot, because actually I had worked in the White House under Barack Obama in the first term, and I'd never watched The West Wing before that. And The West Wing was a huge inspiration for a lot of my friends and colleagues. I don't know if anybody here has ever listened to Pod Save America, but all of them. Okay. My old friends who do that show. It's so funny. They're so famous. It's like amazing. Their show's great. It was a big motivator for them. I'd never watched it. I left the White House because I was just very tired. And I watched the entire series in 2011 to 2012. And it is what drove me to come back to the White House.
Oh.
Because it is very much. On your best days, and it's a show, right? So they write scripts about the best days. But on your best days, it is a moment from the West Wing. There's actually a story in my book that Lawrence reminded me was not taken from a West Wing episode, but is parallel to it because myself and a number of reporters missed the motorcade to go to the plane in 2008 and left President Obama sitting on his plane for an hour and a half, which is actually a West Wing episode. But there are a number of similarities, and I feel very fortunate to have worked for two presidents who are deeply good human beings, even if you don't agree with their politics. And And that is reflected, I think, in the West Wing. And I think, to me, I know we just talked to the man who had served. There may be others here who have served in government. Public servants, people who have worked in government. I mean, this is what I also hope comes across in this book. These are deeply good, wonderful people who are there for the good. And I don't even mean in a political way. Civil servants serve many administrations. There is many overlaps. There's also like a lot more drudgery than you see in the West Wing because it's a show. You're not going to always watch everybody going back and forth with different versions of memos or many hours long meetings. But there are many moments. CJ Craig is like the best press secretary ever, right?
Yeah.
So there you go.
We have time for one last question. I feel so much pressure. Oh, wait. Okay. Well, your friend is pointing at you. So I feel that I must go here.
Okay. Two things. A friend of ours that couldn't be here tonight, but she asked me to send, her name is Sashi. She said to send her undying love and gratitude for your work at the White House and now on MSNBC.
Oh, thank you, Sashi.
I second that motion. And also, the question is, how do you like living in Putin's head?
Oh, I love it. I love it. I mean, look, you know, I know we already talked about this, but the truth is, and I've told people this who have been attacked. You know, there's a couple of young women who worked under the last administration who have come out and been quite vocal about their experience, Sarah Matthews, Cassidy Hutchinson, others. And I have gotten to know them a little bit. And, you know, it's quite a brave thing to do at 27, 28, 29, 30 years old. Very brave. And I tell them all the time what I was told by the Moscow bureau chief, which is like, it's a badge of honor when people are coming after you and you're standing up for what you believe is right. And so It feels good. I don't really like want to be the target again, I'll say, but it feels not bad. And you know, now there's so many of us who can't go to Russia, so you know, it's right. Okay. We can vacation other places. Croatia's beautiful, other places. Exactly.
That's true. Sadly, we have no more time. I'm sure that you all want to hear Jen speak for another 2 hours, just as I do. I have so loved the process of getting to know you. We did not know each other before a few weeks ago, and I feel like, you know, so connected, and you're my best friend. And I hope that you all feel that way too.
I feel the same way.
I hope you feel. We may be setting my son up. We'll see.
I know that was part of it.
Yeah,
Annie, thank you so much. You have been just wonderful. And Annie's book on quitting is like, I talk about quitting in this book too.
You do.
I mean, I'm not again an expert like she is. I just talk about my own experience, but. It's such an important message as well, and I'm just so grateful. I feel like we're new friends, even though we've known each other for a couple weeks.
I actually didn't have a question about it because I thought it would be too self-serving, but thank you for thank you for bringing it up. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.